This is CliffCentral.com.
I am delighted, as always, to see the happy, smiling face of the beautiful Rosie Mutene. It's a pleasure to see you again, Rosie. How have you been?
I've been fabulous. Thank you very much.
Good. Among the many things that we have to catch up on, you've written a book.
Yes, I have.
Now, we can start there because, I mean, a lot of people already know your story, but it'll be worth touching on some aspects of that. The book is called Reclaiming the Soil, A Black Girl's Struggle to Find Her African Self.
Yeah.
So, is this a new journey of self-discovery that you've embarked on? Is it something that you've been in the process, in the progress of for, the last 100 years of your life? I mean, when did this begin, and what kind of a life did you have before that, if this is where you've discovered yourself? Because, you know, you and I are both sort of around the age where we're starting to figure out what we're good and not so good at, what the world has to offer us, what we're not involved in.
And what we don't really have to worry about.
Correct, yeah. So where are we?
It started 10 years ago.
Okay.
And the journey came from a time when I realized that my foster family weren't exactly the type of family that I thought, and growing up. Cut a long story short, my foster brother, who's white, obviously, came home with a black girlfriend, and the family were against it. And I was like, but you raised me. And they were like, no, but you're different. And then that created a lot of confusion for me. Then I got married, which was even worse. And he got married through Lebola, which was even worse. So for a time, my foster family were against it. And then
you were obviously supportive of him.
Very, very supportive. And then I realized, and what also frustrated them was that growing up, I never, ever had a voice in the home. So I would never voice my opinion on certain issues. And this was the first time. So they didn't like that. And then I was getting frustrated because the answer or the excuse that was always given was like, no, you're different. And so that started creating a lot of questions in my life and a lot of confusion. And then I went through a stage of betrayal, obviously.
Because these are the people who raised you.
These are the people who raised me, but also these are the people that I put before my biological family in so many instances.
Yeah.
You know, so I was confused. I was angry. Then it got to the point where it got very, very ugly. And I actually turned to my foster brother and I was like, I was also in the wrong. Horrible things were said, we're screaming and shouting, and that's when I was like, okay, time to let's just take a second gear. So I started writing my frustrations and feelings there, because I obviously went into therapy. My therapist was just like, write what you need to write your anger, your frustrations, and so forth. And then an unfortunate incident happened, that somebody from the foster family got ill and who lived in the coast. And I said, okay, well, you know what, let's make bygones be bygones, let me move down, let's I'll look after you, and let's just move on. And 10 minutes later, I got a call back saying, listen, now's not the time. We just want family around. I was like, cool.
Wow. So you're not in the family.
Yeah. So that for me was frustrating. And then...
Hold on a second. You were going to put your life on hold.
Yeah.
To go and look after this person who got sick, who's in the foster family. Yeah. And then you get a call from them saying, only family.
Yeah.
You don't...
Her husband
doesn't
really want to. It's not a good time. Maybe another time. And so that's when I realized,
Jesus,
I was like,
it's almost like you're dealing with a bipolar entity.
Yeah, and that's when I was like, okay, you're hitting your head against a brick wall, Rosie.
And
when I started writing and telling more of my, and going into my childhood, realizing actually the signs were there from an earlier age. So another example, which is also in the book, was there was a family member who never used to greet me. So I'd walk in a room and you'd greet every single person, but I was ignored and nothing was ever done about that. And he was also a very, very crude person, and still is today.
Yeah.
And I remember I was on holiday with my best friend, Natasha, and this guy said to me, please go turn off the electricity upstairs, because he was fixing the lights. And I went and did that, came down, and in a brash self, in a brash way, said to me, is it off? And I said, yes, it is. And I'm going to swear now, but he said to me, he goes, well, if it isn't, I'm going to have to kick you in your ass until your nose bleeds blood and you snort like a pig. And I'll never, ever forget that line. And I was used to that, and I just laughed.
What a strange thing to say.
Yeah, and I was a little girl. I was in high school. And my friend Natasha ran to the room, and she was crying. And I was like, what's wrong? She was like, what he said to you is wrong. And that was the first time I realized, actually, that type of verbal abuse, it shouldn't be funny. But I'd been used to it for so long, and nobody in the family did anything about it. And so it became a norm. So it was all of these things that
I hate to say this, but I mean, just from the little bit you've told me, and I'm no therapist and I'm no psychologist, but it sounds like this family need therapy. It wasn't so much you that needed it. And maybe if you weren't with them, you would have turned out fine.
Yeah.
Not that you didn't turn out fine, by the way.
Yeah.
But that you needed therapy almost seems to me counterintuitive when there's so much wrong with all of this. They didn't want their own son to marry a black girl, but they'd adopted a black girl.
Yeah, and brought this girl up. But even, I mean, when I was at school, there were other families that had brought up black children, but not to the extent of how I was an integral part of the family. To the extent, Gareth, I mean, even my own mum, I never used to call her mama until I went home. And I used to call her by the nickname that one of the children gave her, which was Bumba, and which was short for Fatty Bum Bum. So it's even those psychological dynamics that when I started writing, I was like, whoa.
There's a lot of damage here.
A lot of damage. And then realizing that, you know, apartheid had its atrocities and so forth. But what my mother had to endure of seeing a child being raised, not only under another culture, race, creed, but I was never hers. And even when I went home.
And you were probably... I mean, you were resentful as well.
Totally.
So then she didn't even have your respect and love.
Absolutely. And even going home was always a big mission. I was always used to make different excuses of why I didn't want to go to Pogeng, and that's where I was born. Didn't really have a relationship with my father. And only after this incident where I was told only family can't come, I had almost like a semi-breakdown.
Well, you had nothing.
I had nothing. I was confused.
This was your community, and suddenly it wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. And I made the very, very brave choice, and I called my mum, and I said, look, I want to come home for a while, and it was going to be like maybe a month to 6 weeks. And she says, cool. And I remember driving home, and you must understand, when I was a kid, that drive home I used to resent because it was going into a different world. I didn't speak the language, different culture, different everything. And for the first time as an adult, I was driving home and I was suddenly feeling a little bit more at ease. And I was just crying and crying and crying. And that month led into 18 months. And while I was there, I started this relationship with my father and realizing actually what the phenomenal man he was. You know, things that the one day he broke out into baritone singing. And I was like, that's where I get my creative element from. I didn't even know that he was part of the choir when I was a kid. And it was the best thing that I could have done in terms of, because I always compared him to my foster father who had passed away when I was very, very young. He was an absolutely amazing man and I was the apple of his eye. But now I could see my biological father as actually he was a phenomenal man. And he passed away in 2015. So I'm glad I had that time with him to get to know him.
Well, I was just thinking now, you know, as awful as it is later in life to discover these things and to feel like you've missed out. There are so many people who never get to have that reconciliation.
Yeah.
There's so many people who will live and they will die without ever having made those connections.
Yeah, and have that bitterness and that resentment, you know. And I've even while I was there, I tried to have conversations with my mum. And even today, I don't know what happened as a child, but the tears that swell up in her eyes and I can see it's painful. And I'm like, you know what? There's some stories that it's okay. But at least our relationship is cemented now. So that time that I spent at home and getting to know my family was incredibly powerful.
I mean, you must feel almost like a different person.
Totally.
I mean, the Rosie Modena that we would have met 10 years ago, successful and self-assured as she was.
Yeah. It was just, put on that smile, everything's cool. Even growing up, you know, people, and it was part of the apartheid. I mean, I had friends who used the K word or whatever. And when that used to happen, I used to just pretend I didn't hear it or underplay it and all of those things. So now when it happens, I'm like, no, actually, you can't say that to me. It's offensive and it's wrong. And so while I've gone through this journey, I've also realized the people that needed to slip away out of my life, which was also another choice and another difficulty, you know.
So much stuff that goes unsaid.
Yeah.
And there's so much stuff that we convince ourselves we're good people or bad people for. And we're all good and bad people, right? It just bothers me that there's this underlying, like, patronizing thing, which I think kids have to endure, full stop. But if you're an adopted kid, you have to endure it more. And if you're an other culture adopted kid, it's even more at an arm's length.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like these people had convinced themselves, and I don't know your foster family, and maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but the way you describe them feels like they'd convinced themselves they were really good people, and they'd done a great thing, and they'd turned you into this girl they could be so proud of.
Yeah, and you, like, should be grateful.
You know, like,
yeah.
Yeah, like God creating something. Yeah. It's just so patronizing.
And, you know, even
ways.
How my mum put it, my biological mum put it, because when I started talking,
and that you should
story,
be grateful, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, of course, yeah. You know. And she said to me when I came, because the deal was, from what I understand from the conversations from my mum and from my foster family, was she had been working for them for many years, and then she fell pregnant.
As a domestic worker?
Yes.
Okay.
My father was a petrol attendant for BP, and she was obviously going to go home to Pugeng, have me, and then I would come back with her and stay with her for 3 months, and then I was going to be raised by my maternal grandmother like my sister. Mm. And as my mum said, and in her words, she was like, I became their new toy. And then after 3 months, they didn't let me go. And yes, in terms of the sacrifices that they did make, and the education and all of that.
And you were loved.
And I was loved. You know,
not like you would be loved by your own mother.
Precisely. And where I was grappling with, and when I started my writing, was when my maternal grandmother passed away, and was the only grandmother that I knew. And at her funeral, I didn't know any of the songs. I didn't know what to do. And I've always been the odd one out. I've always been the white one in the family and the one
but
who speaks.
But Rosie,
funny.
You're different.
Yeah, you're different. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what a thing. Listen, I don't know how it must feel. I can only fantasize about how awful it must be to, first of all, not belong in your foster family.
Yeah, and also not belong in your...
And then not belong in your biological family. Jesus.
And
you really are different because then you don't have a place you can call home.
Yeah. And because of this journey that I went through, so when Papa had passed away, and it was incredibly traumatic because it was 2015, I'd also found a lump in my breast, so I'd gone through surgery, and then he got ill, and within a matter of a couple of days put into ICU, and basically his sodium levels had dropped, so we had to get that up. He didn't have medical aid at the time, and so private hospitals are incredibly expensive. So we were paying that, and this hospital that we were with were incredibly accommodating. So he was in ICU for a couple of days, and they put him into a normal ward, and then the doctor said, listen, your bill is very high, but we stabilized him. He's okay to be sent to a provincial hospital. Unfortunately, he didn't even last a night in the provincial hospital, and he passed away. But if I hadn't gone through my journey and that process of doing what I did for my father, but also the whole mourning period, I wouldn't have been able to cope the way I did. So because we brought him to Johannesburg, so he had passed away on the Saturday, and the morgue only opens on the Monday, so the paperwork, so we had to keep the body in Johannesburg. So I stayed, and then I had to go re-identify the body again, do all the paperwork.
Oh, the trauma, the unnecessary trauma.
Yeah, and the traditional and cultural aspect was that I had to drive with the body to Rustenburg and then do the whole rituals and all of that. And because I'd gone through this reawakening...
Did you know those rituals?
I had to ask. And then you get one auntie telling you one thing and another auntie... Yeah, yeah. So, Rosie, you're not allowed to touch the food. No, why aren't you helping me touch it? So it was, and then I sat down with my one uncle. I was like, what am I supposed to do? He goes, you're the youngest. After 6 o'clock, you don't leave the house. Don't touch the food. Somebody will cook for you, but make sure you get somebody you can trust because we don't want you poisoned. I was like, okay. So it was all of these different things, but... I did it with the sound mind that, well, okay, I've gone through this thing. I am different, but it's my father. And I was able to cope, you know. And then afterwards, you know, I came back and I was like, okay, now let me just mourn. Let me just cry.
You know,
let me get it
this
out.
This is such a great movie script.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be as empathetic as I can, but at the same time, I'm listening to the story going, this is so unbelievable.
Yeah, it is crazy.
When are you going to make this movie?
Yeah.
Because your life is extraordinary.
Yeah. What's so interesting is that I had I was at a dinner party about 2 weeks ago, and there was this young filmmaker, she's in her 30s, and she's doing this film about the millennials and how they coped with moving from like a township going into model city.
And you're like, oh,
I was like, oh, wait a minute. Stories, okay, yeah.
Because, Rosie, when we've spoken before, and I knew your story, and you do have a superpower in all of this, because your superpower is that you can actually understand things from both sides.
Yeah.
Because you've been exposed to both, and now that you've learned about the side that you weren't privy to for so many years, you have that as an advantage, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's tremendous.
Yeah.
So what you need here is to teach the rest of us about those things where we don't see each other.
Yeah.
We see past each other.
Yeah.
The stuff that in society people... We have people who say they're talking about race in South Africa. And race is obviously a big elephant in the room for most of us. We don't know where to start.
Mm.
And that old parable of eat an elephant one bite at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
You've taken a lot of bites out of that elephant.
Yeah. And choked in a few pieces too.
I mean, this book should, I'm guessing, be prescribed reading.
Yeah, well the thing is, I mean, I want to get it to all four corners of the world and to talk about it, because there's just so many... There's different agendas that I talk about in that, but it's also the importance of, you got to know where you come from, you know, you got to have that rooting, and I mean, I ended up converting to Judaism because at one point, and that was in 2011, because I just needed something
to belong to.
And now looking back, I understand why I needed
that. You had to choose the most difficult one, didn't you?
I'm saying.
Converting to Judaism. I mean, they make you go...
18 months of studying.
Yeah, you have to jump through a lot of hoops. So are you still Jewish?
I am still Jewish, but I'm more... I would say I'm a Messianic Jew, because I'm doing... Funny enough, the last 6 months I've been reading a lot of the New Testament, which is making sense to me. So that's... I mean,
and then what about the ancestors?
Yeah. Well, you see, that's the another thing that for me over the last couple of years is that... Because I was always taught that that's nonsense, it doesn't happen. And actually understanding that it is there, but you need to respect it and see it as that. And then seeing the ugly side of it. So I've seen things happen because of so-called Muti and so forth. You know, but now where I am and understanding that is that if you don't let it into your life and you don't let it into your brain, it's not going to affect you. Whereas when it was there, I was like, oh, this is going to happen to me, and then it would happen to me. You know what I mean? So that's the whole psychological aspect to it.
I'm fascinated by these insights of yours, because... You've experienced love from both sides.
Yeah.
You've experienced nastiness from both sides. You've experienced the good and the bad. And you've been able to, I think, remove prejudice from a lot of the things that you might have been either conditioned to nature, nurture, prejudice towards. Are there things about this that have been too painful to write about in the book?
Yeah. Things that, because the book was over 10 years. So there were times that I took off like 6 months because I actually needed to deal with myself and how I handled certain situations, how I literally for a long time blocked out my whole family, biological family, and trying to work on my relationship with my nieces and my nephew because I just pretended they weren't there. How I treated my mother, you know. And then over the last couple of years, what my therapist is we've been talking about is that now it's forgiving myself. You know, for a long time I was like, well, I shouldn't have done that. And somebody said, yes, but Rosie, you were a baby.
And guilt can... Guilt
the guilt. And then, of course, you know, I became Jewish, so the guilt just like tripled. So,
Oy vey,
you know. So it was those issues that were incredibly painful. Issues that came up from my adopted side, especially with the situation with the race. Like that story about, and how those words stayed in my head and what he said to me. And then looking at my foster sister and how she laughed and it was normal. You know, so those areas were incredibly, incredibly painful. You know, and some of them, even like when I was rereading the book again, there are points in the book where I still cry. You know, and the resilience of my mother and that level of unconditional love, because I was a brat. Growing up, and that unconditional
brat. I can only imagine the hurtful things you said to her.
Yeah.
That you didn't mean, but that's what you thought was right.
You know, and there was one incident when I was a kid, and obviously couldn't wipe myself after the toilet, and calling mommy, come wipe me, and my biological mother came, and I was like, no, you're not my mother, and my white mother came in, and it was a joke. So I got away with that. So thinking about that going back, and when I was like, when I moved back home and just looking at my mother and just, she never, not once ever said, well, you've done this or this is wrong, whatever. It's always just been totally unconditional love, which is powerful.
Jesus. It's almost like you let's not get too philosophical about this, but like, you know, your personal story is the story of this country in some ways.
Yeah.
Like captive to a white idea of how things should happen.
Yeah.
And then coming into a world where there's a black idea of how things should happen, and you're trying to find the middle road and find yourself.
Yeah.
It's just very powerful stuff. You know, stuff. Even this is when
my first year at university, and people talking, because now Macaulay House was never political, so we were never allowed to discuss politics there. We never discussed politics at home. So what I saw was just this white is right philosophy. And then going to university, and the year before, Chris Hani had passed away, and that was when I was like, wait a minute, who's this guy that's just been assassinated there? And I remember we were on holiday in Plettenberg Bay, and everybody on the beach was like, okay, it's time to emigrate, Australia, the South Africa's going to go to the dogs, all of these things. I was like, who is this powerful man that has instilled so much fear in these people? And that's when I started asking questions. Then I got to varsity, where I had access to people who could tell me the truth, and books. Because back then it wasn't the internet.
But then you also see how many white people just didn't have any idea of what was happening because their own parents were lying to them.
Yeah.
And you see so many, you know, young white kids now who just are disconnected politically.
Totally.
And it's not because they don't have a conscience or they don't want to be better. They've just been cocooned.
Mm.
Like particularly in like certain communities in South Africa, there's just no real discussion.
Yeah. And the discussion is, oh, well, I was there with
gonna,
the time. So
but what are we going to have for supper and what movie are you watching?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, around them, all this stuff was happening and they were just oblivious.
Yeah, totally.
The one thing that irritates me about people is willful ignorance, right? Where you've chosen to be ignorant.
Yeah.
And for you as a kid, they would say to you, oh, but you've got this life that you wouldn't have had with your biological parents. So now you need to feel guilty about that, first of all. And second of all, you must just take what we say as the truth.
Or are you overreacting?
And by the way, I don't want to come across as being like insensitive to the foster family. Because obviously they had good intentions. They wouldn't have, no one adopts a kid.
Yeah, and especially back then, and nobody just brings in a black kid.
It wasn't easy for you. It wasn't easy for them, probably, for some of the reasons that are obvious.
Yeah.
But, man, I just think about your mother, your biological mother, how she was working as the domestic worker and watching her daughter being raised by these other people, being raised to resent her.
Given hidings, shouted at, all of these different things. And in the beginning, I had my room in the back with her. And then on weekends, I was allowed in the house. And then I was given a room in the house. But if somebody came from overseas, then I had to go back to the room. So it was these dynamics.
This is apartheid in one house.
Yeah. You know, and then when the census man, I mean, used to come around to check how many black people on the property, because I wasn't supposed to be there. It was a game that we played that I'd have to go into the cellar. And then obviously, as I grew older, I realized, okay, there's the ugly looking man with a folder. Let me just go into the cellar and keep quiet. Because I was never officially adopted because it wasn't allowed.
Rosie, how are you not a serial killer?
Well, we don't know about that.
You should be a nutcase. You should be locked in an institution in a straitjacket, honey. You know? I mean, you're so together. And I know that it's you know, when we started talking about this just now, you said it's been a 10-year journey. But I think this is a journey of 10 lives.
Yeah.
There's parts of this that no kid should have to experience ever, let alone the number of times you did.
And
And then there are things about you that make you so unique, so different, that you're in a position to help the rest of us.
Well, that's where, because originally when I was writing, it was just going to be for my own therapy. And then I was like, wait a minute, I need to tell my story, because I'm sure that there's somebody out there who can relate to. And when I was growing up, you know, as a friend of mine said, well, you know, when we were growing up, her parents were divorced. So there was another kid that could relate to that. Your story, there wasn't, because it was so unique.
Mm.
And to the level of, I mean, I used to call myself Rosie Modena Friedman. And then thinking, well, I'm going to, you know, drop the Modena at one point. And I'm glad I came to my senses. You know, so then when I found my first publisher and I sent the brief to the family, and it was mayhem. They were like, no, you need to come and we'll write it with you. And I'm like, no, it's my story. And then I stopped and I wasn't going to, because out of that fear. And then I woke up, I was like, wait a minute. I can't allow this level of fear to rule me for the rest of my life. I'm so powerful in so many other areas of my life, but this, it's weighing me down, and I've got to tell my story. And then by the grace of God, I found I found another publisher, and then I put the book together, and I was like, okay, well, whatever happens, let's just put this out, because the story needs to be told. And it's not just the story of interracial adoption. I'm talking about the areas of abuse. I'm talking about my first year university, I felt pregnant and I had an abortion, and the psychological aspect of that. Another thing which I realized I hadn't come to terms with, because it was, yes, I wasn't ready to have a child, but at the same time also wasn't ready to have that abortion.
God.
And in order to have that, because it was illegal, so I had to go to a psychologist, and I was told you need to use the word suicide and these type of words so that the psychologist can say, okay, she's not deemed fit. They were giving me the permission to, and they called it a termination of pregnancy. So that psychological aspect at the age of 19, and then this was the man that actually beat me up. So it was all of these different things that I realized, wait a minute, I haven't even, let me heal there. And then I went back to writing. Okay, let me heal there, you know. And it's things that you overlook growing up, thinking, well, I'm strong, I can handle it, but I'm human.
Is there hope for us?
I don't know.
you seem to be getting it together.
Yeah.
And you talk about healing, so it's possible to heal these things one thing at a time.
And I mean, I read this amazing book.
That's optimistic.
Yeah, it's very optimistic.
That gives me hope.
But I mean, Brené Brown, who talks about the power in your vulnerability, and I read her book a couple of years ago, and as individuals, we're so scared to reveal our vulnerability because we see that as a weakness. But it's a human instinct, and I think if we look into that and live that vulnerability, and then you move on. You know, you've got to give yourself that healing process, but know that it's like a mourning period. Like after my incident that happened in Botswana, and when my nose was broken,
What happened in Botswana?
So I was in Botswana, ironically, for 16 days of activism.
Yes.
And I was at a party and a fight broke out and a guy punched my nose. And granted, it wasn't meant for me, but his punch was intentional. And cut a long story short, he was a very, very well-connected man, and the police refused to intervene. Was taken to the hospital. They booked me in. They were, you're going into surgery tomorrow morning. And I was like, okay, I like Botswana, but if I'm going to go into surgery, I want to be at home. My doctors, I want to be with my close to my family. South African embassy was closed. Police refused to intervene. So what I did was I went to social media. I said, this is what's happened. I need assistance. I need to press charges against, because I know what my rights are.
If
I don't press charges now, there won't be a case. And also, I was scared because he was so influential, what was going to stop him and his goons for coming to intimidate me? So I needed to get out the next day. Got into Metro FM. They contacted, there were a whole lot of people just working. And that also was incredibly overwhelming because suddenly I got calls from America. And a South African embassy in America was calling me and saying, okay, what can we do and so forth. Managed to get the police to come. We opened up a case. The embassy came in. You know, and that morning, as many problems as our country has, that morning when these two ladies came in, they were like, we're from home. What do you need? I was like, so happy to be a South African. And got the police in. We opened up a case. They rushed me to the airport the next day, and I got on a flight, came back. 2 days, the next day I was in the hospital and having my nose fixed. And at the time, he drove to Johannesburg, got into Fat Joe's show, and made this whole story that, oh no, it's, you know, oh, she was overreacting, all these different things. And it was interesting what the comments that I was getting on social media. So from the Friday night that it happened to the Tuesday before I went into hospital, my Twitter account had increased by about 10,000, majority from Botswana. And the comments that I was getting from people, well, women are being beaten up every day. Why is it a big thing? Because it happened to you. You're so dramatic. Your career really that bad that you need to make all of these things up. And I was like, oh, okay, this is where we're going.
People are shits.
Oh, my God. And so
these are people who are not even involved, and they can't wait to pile on you. Pile on.
And so I said, okay, well, I need to go into hospital. I turned off social media, and I said, I'm going to give myself until end of January to heal. Do whatever you need to do in between there, but we're not going to respond, but I will get through this. And that's exactly what I did. And there were days that I sat and I cried. There were days that I just sat there and laughed. Went to my parents' home and just, I was like, this is my mourning period, because when I rise again, I'm going to rise. And ironically, I was planning to climb Kilimanjaro, and I obviously didn't do the training. And I was like, no, let me do this. And if I can reach Kilimanjaro, I can reach Uhuru, then I can get through this. And I did. It was very, very difficult. It was 6 hours before, after my whole crew, because I wasn't physically fit, but mentally I was there. And then I came back and I remembered that our Minister of Women and Children, I think her portfolio was people living with disabilities, that whole long portfolio. Mm. And I remember a newspaper sign on the road saying South African government need to intervene. And I contacted Interpol. And 2 minutes after that, he called me. And it was a Botswana number. He goes, okay, this is me. This is Bissau. I apologize. I was like, okay, cool. Let me meet with my lawyer in Botswana. Because it had to happen in Botswana because that's where the incident happened. And we had a mediation between him and his lawyers. They apologized. He took full responsibility for his actions, reimbursed me for my medical bills. I also made return trips because the police were saying we don't have enough evidence. And I realized on my second trip back, they were trying to change my statement so it would fall out of court. And then I made him give a hefty donation to a women's organization in Botswana. So
again, like healing, it sometimes takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of time.
But you've got to put your mind to it.
And you've got to take it seriously. Like I admire the fact that you say to yourself, I'm going to give myself X amount of time. Mm. By the end of January, I'm going to... You know, people don't do that. They just carry on thinking it'll get better with time.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. Mm-mm. Unless you consciously make... an effort to heal. It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. And acknowledge that healing and acknowledge the weakness in there, but then also find the power in it. No. You know, there were days that I was just grateful that, well, I had medical aid, that I could do my nose, that he didn't take out my eye, you know, all of these other things. And then even up until last year was the first time that I could actually dive into a pool because of that. I didn't want anything up against my face. And I mean, this happened in, 2013? You know, so it was, I realized, okay, that's also another healing because for a while I didn't shower, or if I showered, I let the water rush against my back because I didn't want anything hitting my face, pressure. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, my nose is fine, but it's still that psychological aspect.
Also, it's just so vicious to be hit in the face.
Yeah.
You know, I need to get to this situation again. You're fearless. You talked about the power that you take back when you allow yourself to heal, and also you get to stand up for other people. Now, you know, this Me Too movement is a very big deal in Hollywood, and it's something everybody is talking about now. There are women all over the world who have put up with men who behave badly, and I'm being, you know, as gentle as possible about this, but there are a lot of revolting situations that have been allowed to go on for too long. And there are women coming out now saying, you know, Harvey Weinstein and this one and that one are all terrible people and this is what they've done and now we're not going to keep quiet anymore.
Yeah.
And you have experience of similar stuff in this country.
Mm.
Well, what happened?
On a number of levels. So first, on a very personal, when I dated somebody and his business partner used to feel me up and also make horrible comments about how women deserve to be beaten up and things like that. And looking back, realizing how toxic the relationship was also, because his argument to me was, the one argument was that, well, you've taken drugs in your life, you don't have a right to be righteous on this. And I was like, these are two different removed things, number one. Number two, his other thing was, well, I didn't see it happening, so I can't stand in your honor. Until the last time that it happened, where I said, okay, well, I'm going to go to the police now. And that, because it would have had an implication on his business, did he take a stand against that? Fortunately, I wasn't in that. I left that relationship. Then, when I started Generations, there was around me, but nothing ever happened to me. And I know it was happened to other actresses. But also back then, we were like, okay, well, we're not going to get involved. Then, when I started reading the stories about what was happening with Carlo Matabane, and I remember the first time that I had contact with him was on LinkedIn. And he had sent me a message and we were chatting and it was nothing ever crude or anything. And he said, meet us for drinks.
Nothing inappropriate.
Yeah.
You had no reason to worry.
No reason to worry. It was about 2006, 2007. He goes, look, I'm going to be in town. I'd love to have drinks with you. Met up with a few other filmmakers. And we just left it at that.
Let's just explain. Carlo Matabane is a very well-known director.
And filmmaker, yeah. Director and producer.
Produced, what was it? Nelson Mandela, The Myth and Me.
Yeah.
When We Were Black.
When We Were Black, I think, was his claim to fame.
Right. And then he's about to release The Number, which is a prison drama.
Yeah.
So he's a well-known guy.
Very well-known.
He's not some nobody.
Yeah. At the time, he was still up and coming. Then fast forward to 2012, I was on the jury for the Durban Film Festival, and he was there. And we had all gone out with friends, and we were all having a couple of drinks and networking, whatever. And he used to put his arm around me, put his hand on my leg, and I didn't think anything wrong with it because I thought he was gay.
Oh, so you didn't even have suspicions about him being a predator or anything?
No, and he said to me, he goes, you know, come, I want to show you inserts of my documentary, this Mandela documentary. And I remember I was walking back to our hotel, and he was like, come up to my room, let me show it to you. And I was like, you know what, I'm feeling a bit tired, I've got to wake up early tomorrow morning, let me come see it after my screening. And I didn't think anything of it. And when we got into his hotel room, we were sitting by the desk, one of those desks against the wall, watching it, and then he was like, do you want a cappuccino? I was like, yeah. And then he went to the phone to call because they were taking their time. And then I turned around, and he was like literally lying on the bed, and he was like, why don't you come sit here? And at that point, I was like, oh, shit, Rosie, you've clocked this all wrong. And I was okay, you know, sorry, this is great, Carla, let me get out of here.
Isn't it interesting that we always expect the woman to know when it's inappropriate.
Yeah.
It's never the men who just shouldn't be inappropriate.
Yeah. And I got out of that situation. And then it was the day afterwards, and we were all sitting in the foyer. And I remember it was Fanny Mokoena was there. Florence Maseru was there. And I think he had bought Bunny Chows. Somebody had bought Bunny Chows. And the minute he sat at the table, I was like, I'm not comfortable. So I took my Bunny Chow and I went upstairs. This was Carlo. And after that, he said to me, he goes, you know, you're such a cock teaser. You're such a cock teaser. And that's when I was like, okay. And I didn't,
wow.
I just said, oh, you know, you're full of shit. And I left it at that. But I still didn't think anything into it. So when I started reading these sentiments that these women were saying of what happened, and the first thing that logged my memory was the LinkedIn and how that was always his first point of call or first contact with any of these women. Fortunately for me, he never ever had my telephone number.
What a terrible place to start, LinkedIn. I mean, it's the least sexy.
You know
sexy,
what I'm saying?
It's the least sexy, sexy social place, medium of them all. I'm amazed.
Yeah.
So has he been doing this with other women?
So many other women. And a lot of them won't come forward. And I've been speaking to them privately. Yeah. And the revolting and vile things that he sent to these women and telling them. And then the situation with the one girl where he raped her, and I do believe her, and how he put a pillow over her head and told her to keep quiet, and even the messaging after that. And some of them have come forward, and they're not. And what I didn't realize was that the one story actually came through last year, but nobody said anything about it. I didn't even hear about it. And so when this was happening, I thought to myself, well, wait a minute. Yes, I was lucky enough that it didn't get to the point where he was sending me these crude messages or raped me, but there was that point where it was inappropriate. And if anything, I need to put my voice forward for this.
Now, he says that he's going to sue anyone who spreads these stories about him because they're untrue. He also says that, you know, some of these women are attention seekers. Mm. Some of them, there's no evidence whatsoever. It's a he said, she said situation.
Yeah.
Are you prepared if he decides that he's going to pursue this legally?
Absolutely. 100%. And I will stand up to him. And also, I think this is also going to be opening the door for so many other, because there are so many other sexual predators out there, especially in the industry. And it needs to come to the forefront. And if you look at the latest statement from the Independent Black Filmmakers Coalition, where for the first time black men have actually come forward and they said, well, we believe you.
Wow.
And almost confessing that they knew what was going on. You know, so... If he says he's going to send me a lawyer's letter, bring it. Let's take it to the forefront.
And there are one or two of these other women who are brave enough to take him on as well.
Yeah.
Even though there are others who are scared.
Yeah. You know, and it's all those tactics of, well, nobody will ever believe you, or you're lying, or you're overreacting. I wasn't overreacting.
Do you think that because film and television and, you know, you hear about Weinstein and Bill Cosby and all these people, do you think that because it's such an attention getting medium, it's such a popular business that it's particularly proficient there, or do you think that it's everywhere in people in accounting firms and in you know, domestic workers, everybody.
I think in every single sector, and because I've been in the activism space for so long, I know that it's in every single sector. And because we're living in a patriarchal society, and then on top of that, people will hide behind tradition. You know, well, it's the African way.
Excuse for some terrible things.
Yeah, and back then, people were like, "Well, you don't know your African tradition, so you can't."
Yeah.
You can't
well, use what do you know? You're Jewish.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you're different.
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah. You're so brave. You gotta have something special going on because some of these fights aren't even yours.
Mm.
Now you're going to be touring Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be telling your story.
Yeah.
You hosted Pan Africa Connect here on cliffcentral.com, yeah. Which I hope we can get going again. You lived in Uganda for a while.
I did.
Was that a nice experience?
No.
Tell me why.
You know what? I was the face of Ugandan Fashion Week in 2005, and I fell in love with the country. So I've been going back and forth for work and so forth. And so I got this opportunity to head up this TV network, head of productions and programming, which for me I thought was fantastic because it's the direction I wanted to go, especially with my agency. But then understanding Ugandan corporates is a very different ball altogether.
Yeah.
So corruption is the norm.
Wow.
I'm just going to say that out there. And I got to the point and I stuck out 6 months. And then one day I woke up, I was like, Rosie, what the hell are you doing? What are you trying to prove? I mean, you know, if I was 24 trying to create myself and create my brand, but they brought me in because of my expertise, and I hadn't even started to touch on that. You know, so, and also the fact that a contract really doesn't mean much. Things that were supposed to be put to the forefront were never there. You know, the person whose position I was supposed to take on didn't know I was coming and then refused to relinquish her duties. So I had to go to HR and say, actually, please just tell her that she's not head of the department. And then when I was making leeway in the department and gaining trust with about at least 80% of my, because I had 40 programs under me and a whole lot of producers, videographers, editors, they were starting to see the difference in believing in me. And then this woman whose position who was still there, but kind of like didn't have a name or attached to her position. Suddenly in the meeting, she would speak in Luganda. And I'm like, you can't do that. She goes, oh, I forgot you were here. So,
wow, such disrespect.
Yeah, huh? Totally. And then when I resigned and I said to the HR, I said, well, I've resigned. I'm due for leave. Should we cancel that and let me just finish off? And he said to me, he goes, no, I'm going on leave and so forth. But go and leave. And then if you don't mind working an extra month, and then we'll pay you out 3 months. I said, cool. Sounded good. Went on leave. While I was in South Africa, I see they didn't put my salary in. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think anything of it. I went back, get to the airport, landed in Tebby, and the guide customer was like, oh, Ms. McDenna, who do you work for? I said, I work for NTV. I'm like, no, you don't. Your work permit's been revoked. Please step to the back.
Oh, you're kidding.
Ching, ching. So
they locked you up?
No, well, they were bringing me into the office to detain me. And then the guy said to me, he goes, why do you look familiar? I was like, Studio 53, Generations. I've done the oh, he goes, oh, you're the famous South African. I was like, yes. He goes, okay, you know what we're going to do? I'm not going to take you in, but I'm going to take your passport, go sort it out with the company. Cut a long story short, it took me about another 2 weeks because suddenly my passport disappeared.
Oh, God.
Once again, the South African government came to my rescue. The ambassador was amazing. Going back and forth to the embassy where they couldn't find it, and was literally, I think it was a call from him, and suddenly, oh, it was in this other safe, we found it.
Banana Republic.
Yeah, totally. I got a lawyer involved who said, no, you're in the right, we're going to get this, this, and this, this. Lawyer's letter went there. Ironically, about an hour after the lawyer's letter went through, the driver, not even anybody from the department, the driver called me and was like, oh, I believe you sent a lawyer's letter, I hope you got a good lawyer. I was like, how do you know about this? No, the MD told me. I was like, what are you talking about? Why is the MD? This is a confidential matter. Then my lawyer called and said, no, sorry, we actually don't have a case. By the way, this is your bill. Please, can you settle it as soon as possible?
Jesus.
At that point, I was a wreck. Fortunately, I had a very, very strong support structure. And I'd already given up my apartment, so I stayed with my friend because it was interesting how people just react to certain scenarios. So people were like, well, what we can do, we can put you on a bus, you can go through Kenya, I got a guard, this border post, you can get it. I was like, but why am I being smuggled out of the country when I haven't done anything wrong? you know, and finally I got my passport back, and then finally I came home and I was
like, what a nightmare.
I literally last due for the couple of months, and I went to stay with my mom for a while, just trying to deal with this emotional stress that I went through. And then now looking back, and I'm glad I went through it, because I've seen that side of the reality of it and the harshness of it.
Yeah, because people also, they either have this idea that the continent's wonderful and it's perfect, it's this colorful place where you can do all kinds of exciting things and the rules are sort of negotiable. And then there are people who think it's just a complete disaster. And it's neither of those things. It's somewhere
and the
in
thing is, I mean, the fortunate for me was also that that last 2 weeks that I was there, because I was like, okay, well, what do I do? So I was like, well, I'm going to drink tequila. So I was literally 10 o'clock after my breakfast. I was like, if I'm going to handle this, otherwise I'm going to have a stroke or I'm going to have a heart attack.
So you drank?
I drank. And they got them, they make some of the best gin in the world. So I was drinking Warraji gin. Met amazing people and partied up a storm.
There's a silver lining in every cloud, right?
You know, and Ugandan people overall have always been so accommodating. So when I saw this happening in this company, it was just a few people. It shocked me because, to be honest, and I'm probably going to be lambasted for saying this, I thought this would have happened to me in West Africa. But now, as my mentor said to me, he goes, well, the thing why we respect, why I respect Nigerians is that you know what you're getting. They'll be brash, they'll be upfront. Whereas this way, people are all very nice, but then they're like,
there's a sting in the tail.
Yeah, which is even more dangerous. Yeah, so.
Crazy. What a life. My God, aren't you exhausted?
I am.
take a big, deep breath. Good Lord.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I love you, and you
thank
know
you.
you're always, this is always home for you whenever you want to come here.
And don't worry, I've been speaking to Celeste, and yes, I'll be coming back soon.
Good.
Yes.
Well, I'm so excited about your book. I can't tell you how important this is. Like, there's so many stories in there that people need to hear.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of you for doing it, because it can't have been easy. And there's a lot of getting to know yourself, which is the point of life, but it's also so hard.
Yeah. But it's also, you got to learn to forgive yourself, which is something that we don't do.
Are you there yet?
No.
That's another process. You think you're going to get there?
I don't know.
Oh my
but
God.
At least I'm laughing about it.
All right. Rosie Mutene, everybody.
This is CliffCentral.com.